with its emphasis on praise and thanksgiving, and we may think that those are out of touch with real life. We may come here and plant our behinds in seats, say things to God, and walk out unchanged and think, oh, that didn't have anything to do with what I see in life. And you see, none of those responses fit with what we see in Scripture. See, the Bible presents us another element, a link between the truth of praise and the response of thanksgiving. It is lament. And I've spent most of my life not grasping it. It seems almost ironic, if you think about it, that the chosen people of God, the people whom he favored, the people he said were the ones he had specially chosen to hold in the palm of his hand, would be the ones to develop a strong tradition of lament, even in their worship. To hear the Joel Osteens of this world tell it, it should be almost impossible for a believer in God to lament. That's only one of the reasons I hate the guy. But almost a third of the Psalms, more than any other genre of psalm, by some estimates, are laments. 32 of them are individual laments. 16 of them are communal or royal laments, where either the people together or the king on their behalf is lamenting for everyone. Laments are found throughout a number of the historical and the prophetic books. In fact,
why are people phoning? We're
6 miles to Chicago. They're going to have to deal with it, I guess. Sorry, I do get work calls, but somebody else is going to have to deal with this one. The English title of an entire book of the Old Testament is Lamentations. It laments the fall of Jerusalem to the Babylonians in 586 BC and the suffering that resulted. And I don't know if you know, but it has since become the custom in the synagogue to recite that book every year on the 9th of Av to lament the destruction of the temple in AD 70. A regular part of worship is revisiting the lament. Now, I want to start in some familiar territory first. Many of us are already familiar with the concept of a funeral lament. Okay, so in English, we call a song like that a dirge. We use music with keys and patterns that suggest or even invoke sadness. The Hebrew word for that is kiyin, or kiyana, translated lament. So in 2 Samuel, it says, then David chanted with this lament over Saul and Jonathan his son, and he told them, the people, to teach the sons of Judah the song of the bow. Behold, it's written in the book of Jashar. Your beauty, O Israel, is slain on your high places. How have the mighty fallen? That refrain of how have the mighty fallen appears 3 times in David's lament. And he's not asking why. He's not asking how it happened. It's an exclamation. But that first word, the how, which in Hebrew is aicha, also forms the first word, and thus the Hebrew title, of the Book of Lamentations. How desolate lies the city, once so full of people. How like a widow is she who once was great among the nations. It's personifying the Israelite people as the city of Jerusalem and personifying Jerusalem as a woman. She who was queen among the provinces has now become a slave. How? How? And when I saw that word appearing to start those two laments, the next word that came to my mind were the lament of Jesus in Matthew 23. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those sent to you, how often I have longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you were not willing. Look, your house is left to you desolate. Okay, so how do we define this concept? Now, I'm quoting here G. Brooke Lester from Garrett Evangelical. He says, in laments, a critical event calls into question the conviction that God reliably protects the speaker from injustice, chaos, and death. Something has happened to shake the faith. The lament psalm then looks backward at praise, recalling God's saving acts, and it looks forward to thanksgiving and salvation, praising God's inclination to save. Lament gazes unflinchingly at the present reality of pain and at God's apparent slowness to save. Lament is the acknowledgement then that something is wrong. Something's happened that makes it seem as though God is either not good, not loving, or not powerful. The best known sensation of this wrongness is the grief that comes at the injury or the sickness or the death of a loved one. As C.S. Lewis remarks in A Grief Observed, he said, there is no danger, I think, that I would cease to believe that God existed. The danger was that I would begin to believe terrible things about him. Or dreadful things about him, sorry. And so that's why I start to help you grasp that. Because that is an experience common to many of us. But there is more to lament than just grief. There are other sensations that inspire lament. The anger that flares up when you hear lies being presented as truth. The outrage sparked by people like Harvey Weinstein and the child pornographers and the human traffickers and the people who drive vans onto sidewalks full of people. The impatience that you feel when Greta Thunberg confronts the world leaders with their inaction on environmental issues, and you realize they haven't even passed a law to require that all packaging be recyclable or compostable, much less addressing the life cycle of the products themselves. The disgust that you feel from deformity and sickness and wounds and the smell of death. The protectiveness and compassion that well up when you see the plight of the weak, the sick, and the helpless. The helplessness you feel when you watch the rich getting richer, the poor getting poorer, and the powerful protecting only themselves and their friends. The dread you feel in aging, as you feel your strength breaking down and your time running out, and you start wondering if you put your time and energy and attention where it mattered most. The weariness you feel when you spend all your time and your money and your energy and emotion trying to make a difference in the world's brokenness, or even to care for one person who's been entrusted to you, only to be confronted by more and more of the world's brokenness. Until you're out. So how do they work? Laments often begin with a direct address to God. From Psalm 22. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me, so far from my cries of anguish? My God, I cry out by day, but you do not answer. By night, but I find no rest. Folks, this was written by the same person who wrote the 23rd Psalm. See, God is the creator. He's the sustainer. He's the redeemer of the universe and of us. And when he made the world, he made it to be good. He called it good. And he made a world with people in it to be very good. That was his own words. His intention was what the Hebrew calls shalom. We usually translate that as peace, but it's a special kind of peace. It's not just the absence of conflict or busyness. It's the presence of righteousness and justice and wholeness and completeness. It's that same sensation you feel when a chord is resolved and doesn't go off key. Shalom, peace, wholeness, righteousness, justice. Now, if God is powerful and loving and good, then all of the things that run counter to love and goodness and wholeness and life and light are not what he wants any more than we want them. And therefore, addressing God makes perfect sense because he's the most appropriate person to whom we can complain about the brokenness we experience. So whether we're coming by ourselves as individuals, whether we're coming together in community, or whether we're representing other people as their leaders, he's the one to approach. Laments also include a complaint. It's a description of the problem, and sometimes it may even sound like the writer is accusing God of injustice. Hear it in Psalm 22. Do not be far from me, for trouble is near. There's no one to help. Many bulls surround me. Strong bulls of Bashan encircle me. Roaring lions that tear their prey open their mouths wide against me. Now we know he's not talking about animals. Those are people, enemies. But he says, I am poured out like water. All my bones are out of joint. My heart has turned to wax. It has melted within me. My mouth is dried up like a shard of pottery. And my tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. You lay me in the dust of death. Dogs surround me. A pack of villains encircles me. They pierce my hands and my feet. All my bones are on display. People stare and gloat over me. They divide my clothes among them and cast lots for my garment. From Psalm 12, help, Lord, for no one is faithful anymore. Those who are loyal have vanished from the human race. Everyone lies to their neighbor. They flatter with their lips, but harbor deception in their hearts. From Psalm 13, how long, Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I wrestle with my thoughts and day after day have sorrow in my heart? How long will my enemy triumph over me? Psalm 44. But now you have rejected and humbled us. You no longer go out with our armies. You made us retreat before the enemy, and our adversaries have plundered us. You gave us up to be devoured like sheep, and have scattered us among the nations. You sold your people for a pittance, gaining nothing from their sale. You've made us a reproach to our neighbors, the scorn and derision of those around us. You've made us a byword among the nations. The people shake their heads at us. I live in disgrace all day long, and my face is covered with shame at the taunts of those who reproach and revile me. Because of the enemy who's bent on revenge. All this came upon us, though we had not forgotten you. We had not been false to your covenant. And yet for your sake, we face death all day long. We're considered as sheep to be slaughtered. Now this verse from Psalm 44 is quoted by Paul in Romans 8. We're going to get to that later. But we need to start by having the honesty to admit to God and ourselves and others what's wrong. And we need to recognize that sickness and injustice and sorrow and oppression and death are a wrong thing. Something that is never God's desire or intention for people. And yet, we have to acknowledge that there may not be a resolution in this life for all of the things that confront us. World Vision, We celebrate the fact that global poverty has been cut down sharply in the last 50 years. Did you know that the average global income has more than doubled in the last 50 years? Not necessarily lifting everyone out of poverty, but we've made gains. And yet we have to lament that in 2019, the world has the largest number of refugees ever, including after World War II. Millions of children worldwide are living where civil war or environmental disaster or political unrest have created such serious instability that we can't even do the kind of help in child sponsorship that we're so good at doing. That's why this Raw Hope initiative that we're supporting with our congregation this month is so important. Because we're recognizing that we have to do something that's harder and more expensive because of all this instability. Because there are so many war zones. Think also of John the Baptist, who sent his disciples to Jesus and said, "Are you really the one who was to come, or should we be waiting for someone else?" Because if you recall, Jesus announced at the beginning of his ministry that he had come to give sight to the blind, life to the dead, healing, release for the prisoners and the oppressed. And here was his own cousin, stuck in jail because he defended the king when he criticized his morals. There was no yes answer to John's hope for deliverance. Jesus had promised to set prisoners free, and he was not following through with his own family. And you know what? Jesus couldn't answer yes, because he already knew that John was not leaving that prison cell in one piece. His call to John, his reply to the question, was to demonstrate that he was indeed the Messiah and call him simply to trust him and hold on. And if you read through the book of Revelation, that is the message to the churches. Be faithful. Trust me. Hold on. Consider Ari Nouwen, who struggled all his life with a deep desire for intimacy that he could not fulfill in marriage or family, because of his calling. And it left him wrestling with being what he called a wounded healer, who was occupying himself with caring for others while bleeding himself for the rest of his life. His refuge was Christ. His refuge was in caring community with the family of God. And there was not going to be a fix. We need to have the courage to express ourselves to God. I remember one time being struck with grief over a loss, and I fought as hard as I could for about an hour to maintain my composure, because there were other people around, and I just got it into my head that I had to wait until I could be by myself and not in front of other people before I broke down. And when I finally was able to let go, it lasted less than a minute before I was done. How much struggle could I have avoided by simply taking a minute or 10 or more and just let it happen naturally? Now, whether it's because of temperament or upbringing or culture, some of us do need help to recognize that it's okay to express the grief or the anger, or the pain, or the outrage of lament. I remember being surprised at how much time the Lord of the Rings movie spent on men crying. There were some pretty long scenes there, but honestly, they were being more healthy than I in the grief they felt. In fact, one of the characters says that he's not even ready to translate the elves' songs of lament, he says, because it was still a matter for tears and not yet for song. Even David, before he composed that lament for Saul and Jonathan that we read in 2 Samuel 1, he spent the entire first day just weeping and mourning. He did not rush the process. He needed time for tears before there was time to put the lament into song. Now realize, the laments we have in Scripture are likewise poetry. They are the art of people expressing their lament to God with skill as well as emotion. Four of the five chapters of the book of Lamentations are acrostic poems. Each verse, or in chapter 3, each set of three verses, begins with the next letter of the Hebrew alphabet. This was not something that just kind of came off the cuff. Some of you may remember that I preached here a sermon that was a lament following the death of my mother. But it was 3 months before I could write it. I couldn't even speak during the funeral itself. So as you lament, don't feel like you have to polish your feelings up before God can accept them. Read the scriptural laments. I mean, even the ones that have been polished into poetry. Some of them read more like an outcry against God than crying to God. Some of them confess sin the way Daniel did, and others confess their innocence in their situation. Consider Job as an example. Have you ever noticed that God is less angry with Job afterward than he was with the friends who kept trying to justify God and saying that God must have had a good reason to make Job suffer? God is strong enough and good enough and loving enough to hear you out and love you still. The lament then calls on God for help. We've addressed him. We've described the problem. Calls on God. Psalm 22. But you, Lord, do not be far from me. You are my strength. Come quickly to help me. Deliver me from the sword, my precious life from the power of the dogs. Rescue me from the mouth of the lions. Save me from the horns of the wild oxen. Psalm 44. Awake, Lord. Why do you sleep? Rouse yourself. Do not reject us forever. Why do you hide your face and forget our misery and oppression? We are brought down to the dust. Our bodies cling to the ground. Rise up and help us. Rescue us because of your unfailing love. In Psalm 3, very picturesque expression, arise, Lord, deliver me, my God. Strike all my enemies on the jaw. Break the teeth of the wicked. In another one, I believe, he also calls for him to break the arms of the people who are oppressing the poor. My friends, we have been too cliche in our glib promises of thoughts and prayers for people who suffer. Prayer is taking action by going all the way to the top to cry for help. Prayer is a protest. It's a petition. It's an act of solidarity and unity and identification with the people being wronged. It's also a recognition that maybe when we ask God to move a mountain, he might answer us by handing us a shovel to join him in the work. The lament also includes a statement of trust. It's a confidence that God is listening and will answer. And it often refers back to his actions in the past. So in Psalm 22, we've got an historical and corporate example. It says, yet you are enthroned as the Holy One. You are the one Israel praises. In you, our ancestors put their trust. They trusted, and you delivered them. To you they cried out and were saved. In you they trusted and were not put to shame. Then in verses 9 and 10, he gives a personal example. Yet you brought me out of the womb. You made me trust in you, even at my mother's breast. From birth, I was cast on you. From my mother's womb, you have been my God. In Psalm 44, we've heard it with our ears, O God. Our ancestors have told us what you did in their days, in days long ago. With your hand, you drove out the nations and planted our ancestors. You crushed the peoples and made our ancestors flourish. It was not by their sword that they won the land, nor did their arm bring them victory. It was your right hand, your arm, the light of your face, for you loved them. The confession is not only about admitting where we're wrong. It's about acknowledging God's goodness, reacquainting ourselves with the truth about who God is and what he's been doing throughout history. We reconnect, if you remember the diagram, we reconnect our experience of lament with the truth, the prior truth of praise. Now here's where I recommend that in lament, you seek company wherever you can. Even if they don't say a word, God made us family to one another so that none of us would have to suffer or rejoice alone. Shared pain is lessened, just as shared joy is increased. Even people who are not believers can understand that. I'm actually part of a group on Facebook that has that as their key word. Remember also that you have the company of Jesus. The Jesus whose anger drove the merchants out of the temple. Jesus wept may be the shortest verse in the Bible, but it is profound in its meaning. Because he understands the pain because he felt it. Laments often promise praise and thanksgiving and sharing the news about what God has done. So basically, it's the promise that when he answers, we will be grateful and publish what he has done. In Psalm 22, I will declare your name to my people. In the assembly, I will praise you. From you comes the theme of my praise in the great assembly. Before those who fear you, I will fulfill my vows. Posterity will serve him. Future generations will be told about the Lord. They will proclaim his righteousness, declaring to a people yet unborn, he has done it. So after looking back at the character and promises of God, look forward. We're told in the book of Hebrews that Jesus endured the cross for the joy that was set before him. Laments cry out to God, but with the expectation that he will hear, that he will respond, and then we will respond in gratitude and praise. And that's how Paul can quote Psalm 44 in Romans 8 and then conclude, well, you know what? In all things, we're more than conquerors. He's not jumping to that conclusion. And I say this because this is the same Paul who wrote to the Corinthians, we do not want you to be uninformed, brothers and sisters, about the troubles we experienced in the province of Asia. We were under great pressure, far beyond our ability to endure, so that we despaired of life itself. Indeed, we felt we had received the sentence of death. Pause for a second. The same guy that said we're more than conquerors said we despaired of life itself. He said, but this happened that we might not rely on ourselves, but on God who raises the dead. He's delivered us from such a deadly peril, and he will deliver us again. On him we have set our hope that he will continue to deliver us as you help us by your prayers. Remember that Paul's a rabbi. He is steeped in this culture of lament, of praise, lament, and thanksgiving. And then he says, then many will give thanks on our behalf for the gracious favor granted us in answer to the prayers of many. Paul admits that things were rough, that they struggled, that they felt horrible. But he chose to trust that God would deliver them again. And sometimes that's the hard part, isn't it? That after you've been let down, after you've been disappointed, after it feels like God has turned on you, to turn to him again and say, no, I'm going to choose to trust this time you will deliver me. I want to mention also that you can look forward to praise from Jesus. As I was meditating on John's message to Jesus, when Jesus sent John's disciples back with the message for John, hey, I am the one, hold on, don't quit, don't give up on me. He turned around to the crowd and he said that John was, oh yeah, he's a prophet. He's more than a prophet. In fact, Jesus turned around to the crowd after giving John what sounds like a very stern warning not to quit. He says, by the way, John's the greatest person ever born. How would you like to hear Jesus say that about you? What if your perseverance in the very trial you and those around you are experiencing is what makes him proudest of you? Can you find fresh courage there? Can you find something to make you get up one more time and keep walking or keep running for the finish line? Because he desperately wants you to cross it. Dear ones, there is no shortcut to the experience of lament. It is a hard road to walk. It's a long one. And there's only so much that we can learn in advance of the experience. Folks, I mean, I'd gone to Bible college. I'd learned the theology about resurrection and about how all of this, you know, I'd even preached on John chapter 11. I knew about life versus death and of the fact that resurrection is found in Jesus, not just an event. But it was when I saw my uncle in a coffin that it became real in a way it couldn't have before. It's tempting to avoid the road of suffering and lament. We can turn ourselves to addiction. We can turn ourselves to ignorance. We can turn ourselves to sin. We can try to find some way to shut our eyes to the brokenness in and around us. But that will never get us to the place of gratitude. It is only by walking the road that we can get to that place of gratitude and peace and acceptance that we see in Jesus and in Paul, where we're able to grasp with not just our minds but our hearts the truth of what Grant's been preaching to us. I want you to remember, though, that no grief is a one-time experience. So be prepared for the pain and the anger to come and go. Some griefs can echo for years and years, and still surprise us years later with a wave that can knock us over. It doesn't mean that there's something wrong with you. In fact, the more we become like Jesus, the more and the more deeply we will feel the brokenness of this world. The more we ask him to break our hearts with what breaks his, the more we'll see what breaks his. The more we engage with the people who need the gospel, the more we'll understand how hard it is outside Jesus. And the more we will need him and his people to share the load as we bring more of heaven to earth, as we bring more relief and await the day when that work is done. So I believe it is worth adding lament to our worship vocabulary, individually and as a congregation, as that missing link between the truth of praise and the truth of thanksgiving. So that we don't wind up with a hole that leaves us or our children feeling disconnected, feeling like what happens here is not connected with what's happening in the rest of life. Worship team.